Welcome to our first or my first Zoom meeting. I'm really excited to start a new chapter and learn some new things with you. I don't have all the speakers booked out, but I've got about four on the books, and I'm going to keep working to add to them. If anybody knows someone that you think would be a really interesting speaker, I would love your suggestions. Email them to me at ann@warfamilyfoundation.org. And you know, I would love context. Lately, what I've been doing is I just find speakers that I think would be interesting, and I just mess around on the internet till I find a contact for them. But you guys probably have a lot of good ideas, so I'm very eager to hear your ideas. And one of these days soon, I'll write up a little survey for the membership. So right now, I'd like to introduce Megan, our new president, and she's going to say a few words. And then we're going to introduce our new speaker, which is Allegra I don't know how to say it. Posinki? She's nodding. They're nodding. All right, go Megan.
I unmuted myself. Hi, everyone. I'm Megan Epos. I'm the new president of WAR. I'm really happy to have Anne taking over for scheduling these speakers and doing other membership cultivation. She's doing a really amazing job so far. And I'm really excited for today's meeting to hear from our speakers today. And thank you so much to our speakers. And happy Pride Month to everyone. These are like especially timely speakers to have during Pride Month. We have so much to learn about the movement or movements from the gay liberation and equality movements. There are so many parallels to the struggles that we are working on to abolish the registry and other law enforcement abuses that we can learn from gay advocates and the history of the gay movement. So I'm very proud that we have two gay speakers this month, Pride Month. And just to be 100% clear, I do want to point out that this is a safe space, and anyone who feels like sharing any homophobic values with us will be removed from the meeting. This is not the space for that. So that's all I have to say for now.
Thank you, Megan.
Thank you.
All right. Ooh, you know what I didn't do? I didn't read up on how to introduce Allegra. Anybody better at introducing Allegra? I know she's a researcher.
I'll step in.
Thank you, Galen.
So
I'm sorry. Allegra, I'll be better next time.
Allegra Posinki is a doctoral candidate at Rutgers University. They focus their dissertation research on support groups, and I believe particularly in the area of prisoner support groups. They also do work, I'm just doing this from memory, so they do work with I'm sure they'll talk about it, but the prisoner support, there's a support group or advocacy group for children and families of people who are incarcerated. That's run by Dr. Avon Hart Johnson. And of course, I've omitted the most important thing, which is Allegra's area of discipline, which is sociology. Sociologists tend to be super progressive and really very smart people. And maybe not economically, I don't know if economically very smart, like it's not the most lucrative field, but otherwise very smart. And ironically, Allegra used to work for Ben Bernanke at the Brookings Institution there. Oh, and right now they currently reside in Washington, D.C. Go D.C. people.
All right, Allegra.
See, okay, that I can unmute myself. Thank you so much. Thanks, Galen, for the introduction. As he mentioned, I am now a doctoral candidate at Rutgers as of a couple of weeks ago, and I am at Rutgers University, which is the State University of New Jersey, but I live in D.C. and am from the D.C. area. So I just want to say thank you all so much for having me. This presentation isn't directly about the registry per se, but it definitely includes people who are impacted by it. And I do a lot of research with individuals who are. And the one thing I would add is that I'm part of the advocacy group for the International Prisoners Family Conference, which is every year in October and is virtual. And I would invite all of you to join. It's a wonderful group that basically brings together groups like yours. And so I do a lot of advocacy with them as well. So I'm just want to confirm how much time I have just to make sure I'm not taking too long.
However much time you want, we'll do the book. We've got the speaker of the book next time. So,
excellent. Okay.
We're fine.
Cool. So, basically this is the first phase of a 2-part, project, slash, you know, advocacy work. Basically, I am looking at support groups for families who are affected by incarceration, primarily adults, because research on children is very complicated and is primarily in psychology. And that's kind of where Dr. Avon, I can post the conference stuff in there at the end. So I'll let you know. So first phase of this is, looking at support groups across the United States and, bringing in a lot of literature from social work, which is an area that I wasn't really trained in until recently. So I'm sure many of you know this, if not all of you, we're a little below 2 million now. We were above, but COVID kind of changed some of that. And I've done research on COVID in prisons as well. We've got about 1.9 million Americans in institutions all over the United States, right? So the majority of those people are in state prisons. And, you know, the next largest being held temporarily in local jails. We've got, you know, youth confinement, immigration, involuntary commitment, which we've talked to Galen a little bit about. Military prisons and things like that. And one of the things that's very difficult is pulling all of this data. So unfortunately, the federal government does not make this nice and neat for us and has to be aggregated by a really good group called Prison Policy Institute. And approximately, we know 90% of these, you know, almost 2 million people are men. But there's a large and growing proportion of women as well. And Black women in particular are more likely to know incarcerated individuals from a variety of relationship types. So that's, you know, not only acquaintances, family members, neighbors, and friends, than white women. And I know from the research that about 44% of adult Black women have had at least one currently incarcerated family member, compared to 12% of adult white women. We also know that 32% of adult Black men and only 6% of adult white men have ever had currently a family member incarcerated. So it's lowest for adult white men, unsurprisingly. So we know there's almost 2 million people incarcerated, but what about the millions of individual people who are impacted by incarceration, right? Think about if there's at least 2 family members per person, that's, you know, already we're up to 4 million people. I would even, you know, double, triple that. That's millions of people, family members and friends, but especially mothers, sisters, grandmothers, partners, and children, are the most likely to share the burden of a loved one's incarceration. And so many studies in this area have looked at primarily the impact of incarceration on partners or wives and children, but not much is known about just women in general. And I think I mentioned this at some point, but actually the most common relationship for between individuals who are incarcerated on the outside is a sibling relationship, which people don't tend to think about. And so we know, you know, that these especially women and family members often absorb greater childcare responsibilities. They can suffer from, you know, stigma and alienation by proxy, and, you know, often have to survive on limited economic resources as a result of someone being incarcerated. And I would argue that a lot of the policy responses that we've seen that's meant to aid communities that are, you know, primarily impacted by incarceration focus a lot on poverty reduction, right, for families, and a lot of measures for reentry, focusing on how families can help their loved ones reenter society, but, you know, not really on themselves. There's not really much on coping and support, and especially how incarceration impacts already existing sources of support. So, right, if you're, you know, if you have a hard day, you would normally call a friend. But what if, you know, in certain cases, you would not want to rely on that individual because they don't understand. So the focus of this first phase was looking at support groups and helping women and family members, you know, experiencing the shock of having a close one, a loved one incarcerated, usually for the first time. You know, how they created these groups and how these organizations help mitigate stigma of two things that I'll talk about, one being disenfranchised grief, which I'll get into in a second, and the other is called ambiguous loss. So my goal here was to look at what organizations exist in the entire United States and what do they see as their role? You know, why were they created? Why does their leadership feel like they, you know, needed to create something to clearly fill some kind of void? To what extent and how do these organizations work to intervene upon how families think about their experiences? And then what do these suggest about the benefits of organizational social support, right? For losses that are ambiguous and grief that is often unacknowledged or stigmatized. So what do I mean by those things? I ended up finding all this research in social work talking about something called disenfranchised grief. And it is called a type of loss that cannot be openly acknowledged, publicly mourned, or socially supported. So basically, this is something where, like incarceration is a great example, but there are often other things where normally when you're grieving, if you've lost a loved one or you know, have other some kind of physical loss, it doesn't have to be a death, you know, you would expect your friends and loved ones to come and make you feel better and bring you food and cook for you and things like that. But telling someone that your loved one is incarcerated doesn't necessarily give you that reaction, right? And so that's what kind of disenfranchises the grief, right? You can't necessarily share that that's something that you're going through. And they talk about six factors that contribute to a form of grief that is considered disenfranchised. One being that loss is ignored either by yourself or others. The second is that your feelings in response to that loss are ignored, again, by yourself or others. The third is that you receive no support for this type of grief. Four, you have limited opportunities to grieve. Five, others condemn or question your bereavement, right? Why would you consider this a loss? Why are you grieving? And sixth, right, the loss is stigmatized. So people don't want to share things because you don't want the reaction. You anticipate stigma. The other thing is called ambiguous loss. And basically, this is a situation of unclear loss that remains unverified and without resolution. And there are two types. Right. There's physical. So a physical ambiguous loss is where somebody's physical body is absent, but thoughts of that person are still present. Right. So incarceration is a great example of that. They're not physically with you. Other examples include deployment. Right. Soldiers who are not physically with you, and kidnapping victims is another kind of example. Right. You don't know, their body is physically somewhere else, but they're psychologically in your life. And then on the other hand, a psychological ambiguous loss is someone's body is physically present, but they're psychologically not there. So we commonly think of people suffering from traumatic brain injuries or in a coma, dementia, severe mental illness, right? So their body is there, but you can't communicate psychologically with them. So we talk about incarceration as being a physical ambiguous loss. The person is not physically with you, but they are psychologically present in your mind. And so I looked into all this research on social support and why support groups are so useful in a way that existing relationships may not be. And so I use Gottlieb's definition of social support being the feedback that's provided by a contact with similar and valued peers. And I think the key point being similar here, right? Your friends may not necessarily have similar experiences to you. And so research that does exist on support groups generally focuses on people with health conditions, which is ironic. I was recently diagnosed and now free of breast cancer. So it's interesting to look at the main research here being about primarily people with cancer or some kind of life altering diagnosis. So there was not really much that I could find on support groups directly related to incarceration. And But I would argue that support groups provide a type of support that your average friend or family member might not be able to, which is a true understanding of your experiences, and importantly, a secure, safe environment in which to share them. And I would argue that even though none of the support group literature really looked at families of incarcerated loved ones, the experience shares some similarities with these other experiences as being, you know, both stigmatizing and challenging. And so there has been a lot of research that shows in the case of cancer support groups that people with especially difficult diagnoses find a lot more support when they're able to connect with other individuals facing that same health condition. And many members in those studies kind of expressed that they did not receive enough support from their existing family members or friends. And so I see a lot of overlap there. And then the second kind of piece of literature that I looked at is this really interesting stuff about something called framing institutions. And so these three researchers looked at basically a support group and a nonprofit for women newly diagnosed with HIV, living in Chicago, I believe. And so they talk about something called framing institutions, and I would argue that support groups are these support groups are framing institutions by generating kind of new language and skills and knowledge that shape how people interpret a new life condition, right? In this case, being the first incarceration of a loved one. And whether or not they ultimately see that change in their life as a platform for future growth. And so in their case, they're looking at how the experience of an HIV/AIDS diagnosis led many women to have to look outside of their traditional support networks. And by coming together with people facing similar experiences, they were able to kind of reshape their sense of self. And start to view them, their diagnosis and their, thus the rest of their lives in a more positive way by giving them tools to reinforce perseverance and challenge kind of dominant narratives about who has HIV and things like that, right? So not all framing institutions are successful, but the goal is that people will ideally maybe not necessarily see their situation positively, but in a new way that they haven't been able to before because they're sharing their experiences with like individuals. So for this project, I basically went on Google and I was like, how many support groups can I find in the United States that have a regular meeting arrangement and are not just not just message boards, right? Must have some kind of formal meeting arrangement, whether that's in person or online. And it had to be adults. And so I just kind of kept going on Google and looking and tried to find as many support groups as I could. And I found about, I think, 25 organizations. I contacted as many of them as I could. I was able to connect with 13 individuals from 11 organizations across the United States. So I have a pretty good, I would say, geographic sample. Although I would like, I would love to find somebody in Florida, if anybody knows anybody. So I basically interviewed all these individuals who had created their own support groups, many of whom had been running them for 30 plus years. A lot of these individuals were retired or semi-retired. And I asked them kind of, what motivated you to start these groups? And I find that basically a lot of these primarily women. I think one of the groups was formed by a man, but overwhelmingly women facing this experience for the first time basically told me they were unlikely to find support in their existing networks and instead really were more likely to find support with strangers who shared their same experience. And so I argue that support groups provide this space to grieve, to experience their feelings without stigma or judgment, can potentially reframe their experience with tools and resources to kind of reinterpret a life situation. Oftentimes, I would argue that like advocacy, an interest in advocacy would fall in this situation. And they provide all kinds of tools and knowledge that is not publicly available or, requires a lot of trial and error and sharing that wouldn't come out from other types of relationships. And so I kind of organized these findings into two themes. One is the role of community and building resilience through community. And the other one is the importance of enfranchising grief. And so I'm going to give a couple of examples from my interviews, and these are all pseudonyms. All identifying information has been removed. And so I find that the support groups that my respondents created really promote resilience by creating these communities where people really understand the unique experience of incarceration, right? They gave two main motivations for starting groups. One was a lack of support. And second was just a desire to meet other people who were facing the same situation. And so I would say that this, you know, my respondents indicated this too, right? This type of loss requires more than just a shoulder to cry on. It really, you need someone who knows what's going on. And so they basically provide a safe space for people to share their stories, but also resources of all kinds, knowledge and strategies that you wouldn't be able to get elsewhere. And so this one woman from a group in the Mid-Atlantic, they have a regular meeting arrangement, and she was talking about how there are kind of quote unquote elders in the group who are long-term members who may have had a loved one go in and out of the system, but still come to the group and kind of act as leaders for the other family members. And so this woman who worked for the organization said, it's the common journey because you don't get it until you get it. You know, you don't feel until you can really connect with someone, like really going through it. And I think that's why this space is so safe. Sometimes we have new individuals come in, but they feel, you know, the connection between each other, they don't feel no judgment. So they're just free, so free to open up. And she talks about how, this one parent had been through a lot with his son, and they had a new parent who came to the group and who really just needed some parenting advice. And, you know, instead of the group leaders, they had this other member share. And it was really important that he, you know, continued to come back, even though I think his son had come out, just to be with others who had experienced that. Similarly, another woman talked about the role of resources. This woman ran a prison ministry in the Midwest. And she said, we were talking about how what people ask for when they call her organization. And she said, most of the time it's about how can I get a hold of them being my loved one. I haven't heard from them in a week. And, you know, how can I find out what's going on? And, you know, things like that. I usually tell them to try the chaplain first at the prison and to call the chaplain at the prison and then ask them to go visit your inmate and, you know, make sure they're okay and call you back. And a lot of times that works and sometimes it doesn't work. So then we go to the warden's office after that. And so she had built a relationship with the local warden. And so she was able to take issues to him personally when families couldn't get answers. And so that kind of relationship building among an organization is also something that's not going to come from someone who doesn't have this experience, because it requires kind of a long-term rapport with prison officials and knowledge of how to communicate with them in a way that you'll get what you want, right? So it's not just a place to share your feelings. It's also resources, advice. One organization explicitly told me they do not share emotional support. They only share resources, right? They want to solve problems. And so I think that, you know, it's preventing the gatekeeping of certain knowledge. And then on the other hand, a lot of them told me basically experiences of disenfranchised grief without explicitly naming it, right? As soon as multiple people told me these stories, I was like, these are all examples of that. One woman named Mona was living on the West Coast, and her son went to prison in a different state. And so they had to travel really far every time they went to visit him. And she had mentioned how one time they bought plane tickets, you know, and they'd prearranged to visit, and they get there and there's a lockdown. And so they've, you know, flown there for nothing. And they had a difficult time because she had a daughter. So she was talking about when her daughter, I think she was about in the eighth grade, when her daughter's brother, her son, went to prison when he first went. And it was really hard on her because nobody in our family would even bring his name up, like he had died. And one Thanksgiving, this is when it all came out, we were going around the table and my husband's family was there. And everybody was saying what they were thankful for. And we got to my daughter and she said, quote, "Well, I'm thankful for my family." And then she just burst into tears and she said, "And I have a brother and nobody ever talks about him and you all act like he's dead." And I would just say that, you know, this quote from Mona really shook me and kind of demonstrated this, you know, very common experience that it was a loss that's unexpected. It's unclear. There's no resolution. Within her nuclear family, there was, but right within her extended family, there was not. And so her immediate family couldn't ignore the fact that her son was in prison, but her other relatives acted like he was no longer part of the family. And she mentioned afterwards that she thought maybe they didn't bring it up because they thought it would cause her more pain. But she said she honestly felt more hurt because they seemed to not be concerned, right? And they didn't indicate that that's why. And so I would say that the unwillingness of her family to acknowledge his absence over time, and clearly the reaction by her daughter, just shows how the impact of ignoring the problem really disenfranchised their grief and didn't give them room to experience that at all. And she even talks about how her daughter's grief and stress and anxiety afterwards increased a lot. And she was very concerned about her daughter because of this situation. And then the last example I want to give is a woman named Donna. She is also out west, and her brother was in prison. And she, her brother, unfortunately, contracted hepatitis C in prison and died in prison before the end of his sentence. And so she talks about how she didn't really acknowledge his death and loss until her mother died later on. And so she talks about, after he passed, my brother, and then my mom passed, and I really, you know, was looking back and I realized that I was living a hidden sentence, and that's where it came from. She has a podcast. I was a victim and I was serving the sentence with him. And you hear me say this a lot. The only difference is that I was serving the sentence on the outside and I realized that that was happening to other people, right? So it wasn't until her mother died that she told anyone. She didn't tell anyone about her brother's incarceration until after he passed away. And she just felt alone. She felt she couldn't mention it even to her closest friends because it wasn't something people talk about. And she said she, you know, this is one of the clear examples where she disenfranchised her own grief by hiding it and continuing to press it down and not even process it herself, let alone tell anybody else. And so not only, you know, not until she was grieving multiple deaths did she really acknowledge how much her brother's incarceration affected her and counted as a loss. And I would say in other cases like Donna's, people disenfranchise their own grief by ignoring their losses, like as a coping mechanism, right? In response to what we consider norms about grief, right? You don't want to process it out in the front of the world as grief if people aren't going to acknowledge it in a way that's not stigmatizing. And so, yeah, it was unfortunate. But, you know, once she kind of claimed that and reclaimed that and started a group, she really felt like she was able to free herself of that sentence. So I would say that, you know, outside of people's traditional support networks of friends and families, support groups are really essential for what for people who are facing what I would consider non-typical bereavement, as they're unlikely to receive what you need from existing networks. And oftentimes those networks are just ill-equipped to handle such a difficult situation, such as incarceration. And I find that the support groups that my respondents created, I would argue, are a type of framing institution because they structure how families respond to incarceration, learn how to adjust their emotions, their finances, their responsibilities, and then obviously combat stigma that they face by friends and family, but also, you know, colleagues and prison officials at the prison and the criminal justice institution. And so a lot of these groups are able to promote resilience through community building, knowledge sharing, best practices, but also a lot of them have self-care workshops and not just, you know, a lot of meeting arrangements like this, where they're meeting regularly and have a speaker talking to them about mental health or other issues that are related to being stigmatized, right? I would also say that support groups provide specific language for changing perceptions and changing stigma, right? And a lot of them will use humor to adapt in difficult situations. There was a woman who was 85 years old who had formed a group in the 70s. And she talked about how, so her groups were originally in person, obviously, and then now she's merged with another group and they're virtual, but originally they would meet in a coffee shop or a library. And she said, sometimes somebody new comes into a meeting and they're astounded because there's laughter. And I promise them, I say, quote, "I just want you to know that whatever you're going through today, one day you'll be laughing with us." I think that's really important too, as a form of power and resistance. Each of these groups used different approaches, right? They didn't all have the same meeting structure or kind of activities, but they all worked in different ways to help their members realign their sense of self, adjusting to a new form of reality. And I would say these groups kind of fill the void of incarceration by providing structure and a way to resist the loss of control that you feel in this kind of situation, right? It's more than just coping strategies. And so I think that's really important. I would also say that they don't, you know, they can't solve all problems, right? Not everything is going to be resolved by even the best support group, but they certainly provide tools and ways to reconceptualize what people's time on the outside could or should look like. Social norms regarding people tied to anyone incarcerated continue to promote these ideas of shaming, what's called courtesy stigmatization, which is basically like being affiliated with someone who is stigmatized, puts the mark on you, and extend punishment beyond, you know, the individual who's incarcerated. And so this study really suggests that families are better equipped to handle the situation when they can acquire tools to enfranchise their grief, process their loss, and advocate for themselves. And so the next phase of this project is going to be actually then talking to members of these organizations and comparing members' experiences to individuals who are not part of these groups. So we can kind of see, get a better comparison of how people's experiences change or do not change as a result of being part of these groups. So thank you so much. Really appreciate it. And I'm happy to answer any and all questions. So thank you.
Can I go ahead and ask a question? Thank you so much. Okay, try to turn my video back on. Allegra, thank you so much. This has been amazing.
Wait, I realized I never shared my screen with y'all, huh? Oops, I had a whole beautiful presentation.
Oh, it was so beautiful.
Wait, but now I want to, well, I'll share it with you so you can look. Oh my gosh, I had this all ready and I see it on my screen. I'm so sorry. Well,
no problem. No, so I wanted to, I don't have as much as a question, but a comment.
Mm-hmm.
So many things that you said struck me so much, and I've never heard them articulated like that before. So when I was 16, I was raped by a stranger and the police mishandled it and like almost arrested me for false reporting. And I definitely self-marginalized my grief because that was the only way that I could survive. And then like 10 years later, I learned that the police hadn't tested my rape kit. But then they did test it once I asked about it. And then my like rapist was caught, who they say is my rapist. And it was like a serial rapist and it was a whole high profile thing. So that had to that came crashing into my life after I had been self like stigmatizing and marginalizing for so long. And then I started a support group in Memphis because there were so many untested rape kits and the cops were finally starting to test some of them and prosecute some people. Did you want to share your screen?
Yeah, I just realized that I hadn't shared this the whole time, so I'm just going to share. I can send this to you all as well as a PDF file, so I'm happy to go. I feel so silly now. I'm like, I'm looking at it, so of course you're looking at it.
Wow, this is such a helpful framework.
Yeah, as soon as I found it, I was like, this is what people have been telling me, and I didn't know how to name it. And once I found that, I was like, wow, this makes a lot of sense and overlaps in some areas that, you know, we wouldn't necessarily consider.
Yeah. Yeah. It overlaps in so many ways. I mean, I'm telling this story about as myself as a victim, but I think that it also overlaps with people who are forced to register.
Mm-hmm.
Because I still feel that the cops like falsely accused me. But anyway, but with regards to the peer support group that I ran for a few years, like the reason that I felt the need to start that was because the therapy that I had tried to get, like what the only thing that therapists would want to talk about was my rape. And it was like, there's so much more that, like the rape is like almost like an afterthought. Like that's not what's causing me distress, like in an existential crisis. Like it's like the cop stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And then, so that's what we started focusing on in our peer support group. And I don't think there were any other resources that did address like the assault to your sense of justice that the cops did on people who reported these serious crimes. And it helped me heal so much doing that. I think we did it for 2 to 3 years, and we expanded it, and other people who had been victimized by law enforcement were also welcome there. And it was a space that allowed anger and also laughter, though. Like we made just such horrible jokes, but that was very, I think it was, it felt like really empowering. So yeah, I want to echo everything you said. And I found the support group experience to be invaluable to me. And I would love if WAR could help facilitate anything like that too for our members.
Definitely. Yeah. I just dropped in the, I'll scroll through what I have too. So I'll just do this, but I just dropped in the chat, the International Prisoner Family Conference. If anybody's interested, they also have a great list of resources by state of support groups. Not every state obviously has one, but it's a very useful resource. I'm part of their advocacy group. So the thing we're working on this year for the conference is information on letter writing and sending money, letters, and packages to state prisons. So I'm working on a full state-by-state spreadsheet of how to contact individuals by mail and what the, like, with links to the actual state policies so that people can like read the legal policy, right, and make sure that what they're sending is correct. But I think you make a good point that this is also very relevant for people on the registry and their family members, because it and on parole, right, probation and parole, yeah, because they're receiving the same kind of stigma. I've talked to a lot of individuals who, you know, their housing changes, or their, you know, someone's, you know, parole officer showing up at 3 a.m. To their house, and they haven't done anything, right? They're, you know, they're just by proxy being, you know, observed by the state.
Yes.
So yeah, hopefully I can share the PDF, but yeah, let me go through here. So I thought you were looking at this beautiful chart.
You explained it very well.
Yeah. So it's very hard to get this data. And unfortunately, state prisons and jails do not want people to have this data and purposefully make it very difficult to find. And I thought that Galen had an interesting point recently at a meeting about these, what are called involuntary commitment. There's about 22,000 individuals there, which is a huge problem. And then again, primarily what I had on here were my research questions, and I can share, hopefully I can send the PDF to you guys, and then it can be sent out to everybody. And so this is the information that I found about the 6 factors of disenfranchised grief, right? So you're having this experience, especially, right, others condemning or questioning your bereavement, saying that you shouldn't be feeling that, or you should be having different feelings. And then I talked about, right, these primary groups, right? My partner could provide a lot of support to me within these last 8 months, but he still doesn't understand what it's like to go through chemo, right? Like, you know, he's not going to know that. And this study is really fascinating. I can talk about it more offline, but I'm trying to work more into this idea that support groups are a place for personal growth, right? You're not just plopping everything down on the table. You're then saying, okay, I have all these issues, but what, you know, one, oh, you have them too, right? So I feel better about myself. But two, like, what are we going to do from there? Right.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's a forum for organizing.
Yeah, exactly. And advocacy, especially.
Yes.
And so then these were the organizations. So I had 11 organizations, but 13 individuals. I could not find anything in Florida. And Florida, we know, is one of the most highest incarceration states. I have no idea, actually, if anyone knows what the highest states are for the registry. That would be interesting to know. But it was very hard for me to find anything in Florida.
Allegra, are you asking per capita or are you asking gross numbers?
I guess per capita by state. Like, do you know which state has the highest proportion of people on the registry?
It's kind of a tricky question to answer, actually, because a number of states like Florida.
Right. I'm going to guess it's Florida, right?
Well, so the problem is Florida, it depends on how you count it, right? Like Florida continues to register dead people and people who have been deported. So they're overinflating the registration numbers deliberately because they get federal funding based on
the number.
Capita. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it's not even per capita, it's their gross number. And then obviously states like Texas and California just have a lot of people. And
right.
So they're registered.
So right. That's per capita. I would still think Florida. Right. And this is the problem. Like in the states, I'm working now with a group in Texas, but in the states with the highest just sheer number of people incarcerated. Right. I would guess it'd be one of those, right? California, Texas or Florida.
Yeah. So I'll connect with you offline. We definitely know a lot of people in Florida, but surprisingly, New York has a very high per capita
as well. Yeah, I believe that. Yeah, a funny story about the woman who was 85 years old. She had many, many years ago, her husband was incarcerated upstate New York, right? And she's on Long Island. And so they're driving 6-7 hours to the prison. And they had turned one of the former Olympic facilities at Lake Placid into prison. And so it hadn't happened yet, but they were there. And so they were just like goofing around trying to check it out. And the officer's like, you know, this is a prison. And they're like, no. Like, we just thought it was the Olympic Village, right? They're just playing dumb, like trying to get access to their loved ones. It was just fascinating, the techniques that people would use to get information that they're looking for. And she had been chastised by a lot of the officers at her husband's institution as constantly giving out her phone number to people, right, for her support group. And so they, you know, did not want her sharing, they were tired of her sharing her phone number, right? So she had to find other ways to do that. So we'll go through these last through, but I basically separated these into their quotes. But yeah, it was very interesting. So I appreciate the.
And they,
I just wanted to open it up to the membership for to ask questions. So
yes.
Megan is obviously still asking her question, but in the meantime, if you have a question for Allegra and you want to raise your hand, do that hand raise it thing. And I think Chuck manages that, right?
Okay.
Yeah, you go down to reactions and click on reactions and then click on raise hand.
Yeah, I just wanted to emphasize also the power of support groups as a framing institution, like you said.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I know. I really found, when I realized there was an organization like this, I was so excited. You know, the idea that there were other people with whom I could, because normal people don't understand. They don't understand anything about the situation of having your loved one on the registry. They just really don't.
Right. It's not like your next door neighbor is going to bring you a pot roast, right, for that type of situation. Unfortunately, they should.
Yeah. And I find that most people just assume that the registry is there to protect them and that it's, you know, they've drunk the Kool-Aid. They believe that the registry is there to keep us safe. And they've had no reason to read the books we're reading. They've had no reason to hear the speakers we've been hearing. They don't have any idea, any of the ridiculous nonsense that goes on. And so, you know, the first thing you have to do is, you know, push back against all their misunderstandings. And that can take a while. And I think our population, especially, you know, because there's nothing more stigmatized than this. So our population, especially, you know, many times I think our families just cocoon, you know, a lot of the guys in Greg's group, they just don't go anywhere. They don't go anywhere. They don't talk to anybody. They just stay home and don't push boundaries, and they don't talk about their issues. And, you know, I think it's time to change that. I think those of us who've got the capacity to do so need to start telling our story. We need, you know, my friends are probably getting sick of me talking about it, but no one else is going to publicize this information than us. So those of us who've got a little bit of wiggle room in our lives and can get away with having these conversations, I think we need to start doing it, as difficult as it is. So nobody's got any questions?
Looks like Joanne.
Oh, there it is. Sorry. Yes. All right. Does she unmute herself or do I unmute her?
I unmute.
Okay. I think I'm unmuted now. I really didn't have a question so much as a comment. I just felt like I attended the WAR conference in DC, and I think one of the best things that came out of it was meeting several other women in St. Louis who are in the same boat. You know, my loved one is currently incarcerated. I have severely limited my circle of friends, and my friends are very nice, but they don't have this experience. And it's been really just wonderful to have, you know, this handful of women from the conference who have gone through the same experience. We're all at different stages of incarceration or being on the registry or waiting for sentencing. And there's just nothing better than having other people who understand what's going on and how you feel. So we don't really have a formal schedule of meeting, and we need to work on that. But don't you think, Anne?
I do.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And that's it.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
We've got Michael. Hey, you're...
I was wondering if I could, I don't know if you talked about it at the beginning because I logged in a little late. The chapter 7 readings, I got some questions about what I read because I don't know if I'm interpreting it correctly. So are you able to answer anything for that?
I could try.
Okay. There was an issue with, you know, abolish the registry, you know, nothing. But in paragraph 1, line 9, there is a case for allowing the registry to exist, but certain offenses should be on it and certain offenses should not be. So
I don't think that was the author's opinion. If I remember what you're talking about correctly, there historically, the gay movement, because they were themselves being persecuted to such a great degree, some members of the gay movement said, you know, they were very interested in getting cruising and you know, consensual behavior between grown men. They wanted that to be taken off the registry, right? Okay. That was their primary issue. And so because that was their primary issue, they basically, you know, some of them said the registry is a terrible idea, we shouldn't do it. But some of them said, you know, because a lot of the time all gay men were being painted as pedophiles and, you know, terrible perverts and awful human beings and, you know, violent criminals. Some members of the gay movement said, well, we can't push back against the registry because it'll make people believe that we're pushing back against it because we are violent criminals who are targeting children, but we're not. So some people said, well, I guess we'll just agree that the registry is a great idea for violent criminals and people attacking children so that it will differentiate us as we're just normal, you know, consensual, you know, we're good guys. Those are the bad guys. And I think Galen spoke to this last month, whenever that was. Any of us throwing someone else under the bus and saying, well, I'm not the bad guy, it's those people over there who deserve to be on the registry. When we do that, we lend credence to the idea that the registry is valuable for some people, but not for others. when really it's a human rights abuse for everyone. And if we could quit doing that, quit othering, quit separating ourselves from separating some people from other people, and just stand up and say, it's bad for everyone, even the worst of the worst. And, you know, I had an experience in DC that really was, you know, just kind of woke me up a little bit. I was just sitting talking to a guy outside the Capitol building, I think. And, you know, we're just chit-chatting as you do at a conference about something you both care about a lot. And he said, I'm one of the worst of the worst. Like, I'm the people that everyone thinks should stay on the registry. He said, and you know, we'd been talking for 10 minutes and he was a totally just a regular guy. And he said, I've had a lot of therapy since then. I've done a lot of, you know, soul searching. I figured a lot of things out, why I did what I did, how what happened to me as a kid impacted what I did. And, you know, this wasn't the therapy that the, you know, your PO makes you go attend. This wasn't the, you know, the fake therapy. This, he paid extra and he got real therapy that really helped him. And it just really made me stop and think, you know, I had been guilty, I think, like probably a lot of us, at least at the beginning, of saying, well, my loved one only did this, you know, really small crime. And, you know, these other people did a really heinous crime. And I think it's easy to want to think that your situation is better or different or somehow, you know, more acceptable, but that's not really what we want to do. We don't want to throw anybody under this bus. It's a terrible bus. So I don't think that the author, Scott DiOrio, is by any means saying that the registry should be there for certain people and not for others. I think Scott DiOrio, and he'll be on next month or next 2 weeks from now, and he could clarify this for us. But I think he was just saying, you know, in the 70s, when the gay rights movement was deciding how to come down on this, basically, you know, I wrote a little note about this. He said the goal of this essay is to show why it is important to contextualize this much discussed turn to the right in gay politics and to resituate it in the larger political landscape, specifically to see how it developed within the limitations of the larger political culture in which gay rights activists were operating. Basically, let's not blame the few gay rights activists who agreed that the registry was a good idea. Let's not blame them for that, because they were under intense scrutiny and under intense, you know, they were being harassed and mistreated, and it's not really fair to expect them to act in a very magnanimous way and, you know, be helpful to everyone, because they were themselves under attack. Does that answer your question? I hope.
Yeah, kinda, I guess. I mean, it's clearer than it was, because my initial interpretation is these people need to be on the registry, so we should have a registry, and these, you know, and just have fewer offenses that were registrable. That's how
I think that's the situation that they felt like they were placed in at the time. And what he's saying is that there were also plenty of gay rights activists in those days who were saying it's a bad idea for everyone. And those voices got outshouted, right? They got shouted over. And what he's saying is we should go back, you know, what's the word for bring back into the fore those ideas, because there were gay rights activists in those days who were saying it's a terrible idea for everyone. We need to go back and bring those ideas back to the surface and reconstitute them in present day.
Okay. I had a couple other lines that I found that, you know, I thought would focus on othering, but, you know, I think we've cleared that up as much as we probably can.
Okay.
Michael, if you don't mind me cutting in for a second, I'd love to come back to the book chapter discussion in a second, but we never really closed out the Allegra portion of the program. So can we see if people have questions for Allegra still? And if not, of course, Allegra is welcome to stay on for our conversation about Scott DiOrio's work. You know, I just wanted to sort of keep it together. And it looks like Mr. Chung perhaps has a question.
You're unmuted. Thank you. Allegra, thank you so much for this presentation. I had never thought about, at least I didn't allow myself to think about it for very long, what my family went through when I was arrested. And when you were talking about the disenfranchised grief, it reminded me of something that happened actually just yesterday. I was cleaning out a drawer in the desk I used, which my late mother had. And in it, I found a card that somebody had sent them. And this is the other side, that every now and then there were people that reached out, and it was from friends of theirs. I don't recognize the name, but it says, you know, we just got back in town. We heard how the trial went. We are so sorry, and we are still here for you. So there is, every now and then, there is a shining bit inside of all this darkness.
Yeah, no, it's so helpful to have that. A lot of people don't have that. So that's wonderful too. Thank you.
Yeah, I wasn't with my partner when he was arrested or in jail. We didn't meet till after he got out, but I can only imagine how that feels. You know, I know Joy and I have talked about, you know, just how terrifying it is for her to not know, you know, who's still with her and who's not, you know, who's on her side and who isn't. And it's, I imagine it'd be very, very scary to be in that situation where you just don't really know who your friends are. And I
or you don't want to find out who is, right?
Right. So you just don't even ask.
Yeah.
Just hope they didn't read the paper. Does anybody else have questions for Allegra? All right. Well, Allegra, we really appreciate you coming. I find your presentation to be very fascinating, and it really hit home with me on a number of ways. I love that you're doing this research, and I wish you the best of luck. How long do you think this dissertation or your process of getting your PhD is going to take?
Well, probably another year and a half. I'm waiting. I have to go through my institution to like approve the research. So it's in their hands. So I just have to wait until they say I can start, and then I can start. So hopefully get to know more of you all.
Well, yeah, I think Galen will help you find some people in Florida. Maybe that'll help.
Yeah. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Allegra. I loved hearing about your research, and I would love to connect with you also.
Yeah, that'd be great. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
All right. Well, I guess, should we open up the floor? We have about 20 more minutes. Do we want to have some conversation about the book? Does anybody have other questions? I know Michael already started one. I kind of typed up a few notes, but I'd be willing to entertain any questions before we start.
Yeah, so I'm thrilled to be talking about this. I pored over this book when I was in solitary. Absolutely loved the compilation. This is not one of my favorite essays because it does to me sound like Scott's trying to play the apologist for the gay rights community. And I totally get the argument that he's trying to make that, oh, well, not all gay people thought this. Just some people that were like running shit. And to me, that's a really weak argument, right? Like to me, there's a difference between normal people and the like institutions that are running a movement. And the institutions running the gay rights movement made a very deliberate, calculated choice to screw people because they thought it would be good for them. And so I have feelings on that, but I'd love to hear, you know, I'd love to see a show of hands. Who actually read it? Just out of curiosity. Oh, that's a lot of hands. All right. And keep your hand up if you enjoyed it. Okay. All right. So we're like, I don't know. I'd say that's like a third of people actually. Oh, except for there's some people in the, all right. Yeah. So, I mean, what was the most shocking thing to you, Anne?
I found a lot of similarities between, you know, the kind of entrapment situations that were happening, you know, where an officer would pretend to be just a regular plainclothes person. And that one story of the guy named Jennings, who a cop followed him home. They met, you know, in a park or something. I think a cop followed him home, parked on his divan and started making lewd gestures, tried to force the guy's hand down his pants, and then, you know, slapped on some cuffs and said, you know, got you. That to me felt like, huh, some things never change. You know, pretending to be one thing to try to trap someone into doing something wrong, it's just as bad, you know, what they did to this guy Jennings and all the other people like that. It's just as bad as when they pretend to be a 13-year-old or a whatever and start conversations with a person to try to trap them. And it's the same thing that happened to you. That seemed very familiar to me. And it felt like, you know, the police, you know, it just further makes me understand that they're not actually that concerned with catching actual criminals. They're more concerned with manufacturing criminals to fill prisons and, you know.
So to be clear, I think that many of them believe that the two are the same thing. That if they create a criminal, then you really were a criminal all along. Therefore, they're just catching somebody before, you know, they do something that they would have done otherwise. It's sort of a source of self-fulfilling argument, but yeah, there's a lot of that. So I'm curious, you know, other people, what was surprising to, I mean, did everybody know about the history of the registry coming from the criminalization of gay men? I'm seeing a lot of heads shaking now. Oh, well, of course Marty does, yeah. And a lot of people are still off camera. So that was surprising, maybe. Were you surprised that the gay rights, what about the conversation that Scott engages in around the like heteronormativity of the gay rights movement? Was that, did that strike anybody that they were like the mainstream folks politically were trying to make the argument that they were just like the straight community and therefore no different?
You're talking specifically about the part where they kind of gave up advocating for sexual freedom and instead started mainly working on gay marriage just to try to say.
Yeah, they want to be straighter than the straight people. They want to be in the military. They want to get married. That's like big. Anyway, these are like classic arguments against the sort of mainstream organized LGBT rights community. What about, you know, early on in the essay, and I think he sort of gets into this a lot more in his conclusion, Scott talks about how like the process of creating who is and is who is not a quote sex offender. Was that surprising or striking to anybody? And if so, I'm curious why.
Can you repeat that question?
Yeah, so Scott talks about how different groups participated in a political process that effectually manufactured, quote, the modern sex offender, right? So it's in the title of the essay, it's the creation. And obviously we tend to avoid these dehumanizing terms, generally speaking. But here it's particularly relevant because he's invoking this particular label and he's essentially getting at the idea that the label is just made up. If you're creating it, then it wasn't a thing that it's not like an apple, right? It's not like we have apples, you can name it or whatever, but it's a thing. This is like a category that they've manufactured from whole cloth. And I was curious if anybody thought that was particularly salient or what that might say about how to create change moving forward.
That's a really good question. Yeah, I found that whole section pretty interesting where they kind of shifted the focus away. You know, first they were worrying about throwing gay people in jail for cruising in parks. And then when that was no longer socially, you know, when that was that argument was no longer winning, they had to come up with something else. And so they turned the focus on, you know, women and children as the innocent victims. And at first they said it was, you know, men, primarily white men, as the protectors. And then later, you know, it turned to the protectors were, you know, social workers and, you know, victims advocates groups and victims rights groups. So, you know, I'm not sure I completely know how to turn that into how to win how to win the day and get the registry abolished. But it was very interesting. You know, it just makes you understand that a lot of this is just it's being driven. You know, someone's driving us where they want us to go. And you know, most people are just swallowing it. You know, they're just drinking the Kool-Aid and saying, oh, okay, yeah, you're right. Oh, absolutely. We gotta export the sex offender registry to all the states and all the, you know, countries of the world because it's making us so much safer when really it doesn't. Oh, we got a hand up. John.
Davis first and then John.
Oh, Davis. Okay.
Well, sadly, that technique has worked well throughout history, you know, creating an enemy and then give them that as something that the rest of the people that you, you know, your side can other. And if we have somebody to fear, then that's somebody that we can take action against and make us feel better, regardless of whether or not anything actually is made better. When I look at the sex offender registry, I just see it's the legal placebo. It, you know, people feel good, not really doing anything, but no, it feel good to do that. You know, I think back, my field of study was history, and I think back to, you know, posters that are made during war. And you look back at World War I, World War II posters, you know, what is the enemy doing? Coming after our women and children. And so, you know, some of that stuff that was in that article about having to protect our women, protect our children. Sadly, our species does that a lot. The things that really got me out of reading that article was so many of those things were happening while I was growing up, and I was just clueless about because I was young. I was, you know, in my early age and didn't know what was happening. But then just thinking about, you know, well, you know, we have made progress. We got a long way to go, but, you know, that was, you just look at it. It reminds me, I had an interaction with a checkout person here in town, and she was noticing my name, and she, you know, my father was Korean, and this girl that was checking out was also Korean, and she was saying, you know, oh, it's kind of nice to see that name, and I said, but I had to tell her, but, you know, when my parents got married, how different things were. Their marriage was a felony because it was interracial. You know, they got the priest married them in the district in D.C., and then had the wedding. They were already married in Arlington. And by that time, they already had the car packed, and they were heading off to a dad's duty station in California, because if they had spent the night in Virginia, it was a felony. So, yeah, changes are being made, but got a lot to go. And we're kind of at that stage right now with our problems, the problem society has with us, that we've seen before. So perhaps we can learn something from them from the past.
Yeah, I think that's really powerful, the lesson of history. And I also wanted to flag briefly that Allegra chimed in the chat and highlighted how if it's made up to start off with, you can unmake it. So John, what was your perspective?
Oh, thank you. First of all, I'm going on the assumption that everybody can hear me. In reading that particular chapter, and I went on ahead and read the following chapter. What they might do.
Laura Mansnerus.
Well, as a historian, I do appreciate and think it's very, very necessary to have the historical perspective seen in those particular chapters. And again, just a comment, I'm not sure if it was outside maybe the original, say, parameters of the research they were doing. But one thing, I was a little disappointed in that particular chapter 7 is the apparent, tacit, I don't want to say admission, but maybe going along with a view that sex offenders are all these great monoliths, that the entire structure, the entire label, that all sex offenders are all alike. It doesn't matter if their target was, say, a female child, a teen, bisexual, an elderly man. I just couldn't get over the fact that it just seemed like there was no real effort to acknowledge the recent work that's been done by quite a few people to say that that within the ranks of quote unquote sex offenders, you have to understand, you have to realize that people on the registry are not monolithic. They're not all alike. And along with maybe or the assumption that all offenders are going to be male and that all offenders are going to be adults. and the people who have been doing the research, and I've had the pleasure of talking with more than a few of them, that ain't the case. That if you're dealing with this particular area of criminal justice reform, you can't, you must not go on the assumption that all offenders are all alike, that all offenders fit into this assumption, this particular description, this particular category. And I'm curious if anyone else kind of had that feeling, kind of had that response as I did.
That is so, so true. I mean, right now they say 25% of the people on the registry are children.
Yes.
The children the registry is supposed to be protecting. So we're assuming that the registry is out there to keep us safe when actually the registry is waiting to suck our kids in. I mean, my own daughter could be on the registry if she, you know, and she sent naked pictures to some boy in high school and she wasn't old enough. And yeah, she could be on the registry. This is, and they're sweeping up broad swaths of kids for just ridiculous, you know, things that are just completely, you know, the 9-year-old who's on the registry for playing doctor with her 6 and 7-year-old brothers. Like, I played doctor when I was a little kid, and I think a lot of people did. And the idea that we're going to start putting people in the registry for that, I think we need to start, we need to get everybody as outraged as we are. Because I think once people realize how bad it's gotten and how they're using the registry in ways that nobody thinks peeing on a building should put you on the registry, because we've all peed on buildings. Nobody thinks streaking at a football game should put you on the registry, because we've all done that. Nobody thinks, you know, waking your boyfriend up with a blowjob should put you on the registry, but it could. Or dating someone who's just, you know, that you were both under the line and it was okay to date. Then one of you crosses the line and suddenly it's not okay to date anymore and you could go to jail for that. Most people realize that that's ridiculous.
And you're supposed to know where that line is. Say you're in a bar and you had a few drinks and you're looking at a potential sex partner. And if you're in such a condition and they are in the bar and you jump to the conclusion, you jump to the assumption that that they are there, they are legal, they're old enough. I imagine, I'm being a little snarky now, that you're going to say, well, before we go to bed, before we start having a lot of fun, you have proof of ID, you have proof. Show me the proof that you're, And again, there's something else, and I try to bring this up every opportunity. If, and again, my apologies about preaching to the choir, but this is something to be asked, I think, again and again. If the registries are supposed to keep us as a society, as a people, safe, then someone please explain to me why, the overwhelming majority, 95%+ of all new assaults are done by someone who is not on a registry. Please, someone convincingly explain that to me and to everybody else. Is there someone out there who can do that?
Yeah. All right, Mike, I'm going to let answer that. You ask your question or make your comment.
Hi. I we were talking about sort of the youth and that kind of stuff. I tune in. I'm from Massachusetts, the Boston area, a little bit of Rhode Island, but primarily the New England area. And just last week we had a pretty important event at our state house. It's called Youth Justice Day. And we're doing a lot in our state to basically raise the age of majority to 18, possibly to 19 to 20, because they're realizing that a lot of the youth in our state, they're coming out of the welfare system. There's kids from all different backgrounds, and they're just getting jammed up in the system. And so ultimately, you know, it's telling our story. Now that we're adults like myself, it's telling my story as well as some other people. There's a lot of advocacy groups. But yeah, it's really heartbreaking. I just wanted to chime in real quick and say that, you know, a lot of these kids, you know, they don't, their cognitive abilities aren't fully developed yet. We know that their frontal cortex isn't developed yet. You know, our parents' health insurance can cover these kids until age 26. They can't even buy cigarettes until 21, yet they can join the military and go to Afghanistan. But they can't make decisions on whether or not they want to have sex with their boyfriend or their girlfriend. You know, it's a mess. It really is. And it affects, many different people that go through it. I have a pretty lengthy criminal record from when I was a kid. I have two felonies. I have six misdemeanors. It affects, you know, my career as an adult. It affects the sustainability of my family. It affects, you know, I come into this, registry, if you will, inadvertently. I was never actually supposed to be on the registry. I was blessed. And ultimately I found myself going onto the registry decades later because of a misinterpretation of how, my judgment and how my case sort of went. And so like, you know, I enjoyed the read, the chapter. I found it very enlightening, or not enlightening, but I found it interesting. I didn't know the history of how this came about. You know, I figured the system, the government, they're trying to track all this stuff. I didn't realize kind of where it came from, how it evolved through society to where we're at now. And these bastards at will think that they know, you know, what we need as a society, and they know what to do. And clearly they don't, because it's more of a mess now than it was, you know, when they were developing this stuff. They've had so many sort of interval phases that they keep shape-shifting through to solve a problem. And here in Massachusetts, we just keep throwing money at stuff. And all we're doing is putting more kids in jail. We're just giving more kids, more kids prison sentences. One of the speakers at this event said that, you know, we have some towns and some of these adults in these Latino communities, when they get jammed up in selling drugs and guns and stuff like that, they hand the juveniles the drugs and they say, hold this, because you're a juvenile, you won't go to jail as long. So these kids do things not because they know why, but because their safety net of their adults is telling them, you know, just hold this gun for me, you know, whatever. And if these kids have misdemeanors under their records, you know, it's 15 years mandatory prison. And we're sending 15-year-olds to jail for, I mean, these kids won't even be able to get out or even buy cigarettes or do anything. So, I mean, that's a whole nother conversation. But I mean, I definitely can vouch for the situation of the registry. I mean, like I said, my situation when I went through it when I was in high school and the court system, I had a lot of trauma and anxiety and fear and emotion and stress, and so did my family. And I'll tell you what, being on the registry outweighed any sort of trauma that I ever came to be, even going through the court system. It was horrible being on the registry, how society looks at you, how they treat you, how they interact with you, how they come into work and harass you. It was horrible. And it's not something that, I mean, fortunately I'm not on the registry anymore. But I know what it was like, and it was horrible. It was really, 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 really horrible. And they just pull you in. Look, I'm from Massachusetts. We had the Salem witch trials. That's what we had. You guys all know what it was. And this is what the modern day Salem witch trials is. It's calling someone a sex offender and hanging them at the stake. That's what it is. Without any knowledge about it or thinking about it, it's a pandemic. It's not right. And we need to like work as a team to sort of fix this. And one last thing that I wanted to say, and I think this is actually pretty important, and I've actually never seen this happen before, but I'm in this big conference room at the State House in Massachusetts. There's a podium, there's a bunch of senators and reps, and all these advocacy groups are around me. And these two young ladies go up and they say they want to do an interactive thing with all of us. And would we be interested in doing it? We said, sure. And everyone is from all different walks of life and background. She said, this is what we're going to do. I'm going to count to one, and then someone else is going to count the number two, and someone else is going to count the number three, and someone else is going to count the number four, and so on until we get to 10. And if anyone sort of tramples over anyone else, we have to start this over again. And so we all did it, and we got to 3 and we got to 4 and we kept having to do it over again. And she said, all right, now this is what we're going to do. We're all going to take a timeout. I'm going to let you guys figure out a plan. Now, no one can say what number they're going to call, but everyone needs to, like, maybe someone on this side says the odd numbers, someone on that side says the even numbers, and we're going to get through this. And so we did that, and ultimately we got through it. And she asked us, you know, what did we learn from this team building exercise? And what we learned was we're all going in the same direction, but when we speak over each other, we can't get to where we need to be. But it takes all of us to do our jobs individually to get where we're going, right? And so what we have to do as advocates is approach everything. We got to work together, because when we don't work together, we lose our identity. We lose our core. And the people that we're trying to, you know, get through this clouds to, you know, these people are dumb people. They don't see this stuff. They're not on the Zoom meetings with us. They don't look at the research. They don't look at the graphs and the spreadsheets. And they need to be enlightened. They need to stop being ignorant, and they need to start looking at the math and the numbers and how it relates to society. You know, it's ultimately, it's our job to, you know, get this to everyone, every rep, every state rep, every state senator, everyone, right? And so that's kind of what I had to say. I'm sorry that I rambled on, but
that's all right. I want to be respectful of everyone's time, and we're a little bit over already. So this gives us 2 weeks. Those of you who hadn't yet read the chapter, it's only about a maybe 30-45 minute read. It'd be really fantastic if everybody had a chance to read it between now and when Scott comes on to talk to us. And maybe we could even, you know, write up our questions and kind of have some things ready ahead of time so that we could use our time more wisely. I really appreciated all of your time and attention, and I look forward to seeing you in 2 weeks. Chuck, can I have a quick question? A lot of people were messaging me saying, oh, I can't make it. Will it be recorded? I don't really yet understand. We always record the meetings. Where do they go, and how do you see them later?
That's probably a dumb question. they get stored, and we have to determine if it's all okay, you know, to make public or not. And then it has to be edited if there's stuff that needs to be edited out.
So if a member had messaged me and said they couldn't see the meeting, what's the process if they want to be able to watch a recording?
They have to wait until we have time to go through the.
Well, of course.
Edit and all of that.
Of course, they have to wait till it's. But where do they go then?
We put them on YouTube as unlisted videos. And then everybody that got the invitation to the war room will get a link to that unlisted video. So they can't search it on YouTube, but using the link that we mail to them, they can watch it.
So have I gotten links before and not even noticed it?
I don't know. I mean.
Okay.
they've been right. Quite a few times.
There's a lot of emails. Yeah. There's so many emails.
There is.
My head wants to explode. All right. Well, thank you, everybody. I'll see you in 2 weeks. Have a great night.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, everyone, so much. Bye.
Oh, and especially thank you, Allegra.